Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Barack Obama, economic recovery and leadership from California. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Barack Obama wants massive spending for infrastructure, green technology, and 2.5 million jobs. What are the benefits and the risks of what he calls a jolt to the flagging economy? Also tonight, Obama says California leads the nation on energy and the environment, and backs that up with appointments to his cabinet and the White House. On Reporter's Notebook, LA's most successful anti-gang program needs money. First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Barack Obama has reached out to California for ideas and two major appointments, saying this state leads the nation on energy and the environment. That story at 7:30 tonight. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Obama wants a federal spending program comparable to the interstate highway system created during the 1950s, but it won't look like his campaign promised to rebuild America, at least not right away. The sagging economy has put a premium on speed rather than the kind of projects that make for a historic legacy. That's according to Alec McGillis of The Washington Post. And Alec, thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure, glad to be here.
So what kind of projects are we likely to see at the outset?
Well, a lot of the states are coming up with these lists that include really a lot of routine kind of repair and maintenance projects. It's repaving highways, it's redecking bridges. The states kind of heard the word from the Obama team that they had to spend this money quickly. And so what they've come up with are a lot of these kind of upkeep projects that can just be started right away, shovel ready, as they call it. And that's not really what he'd been talking about all along during the campaign.
What was he talking about?
Well, during the campaign, it was these much grander projects. It was, you know, bringing us into a whole new era of rail, connecting all the Midwest cities with intercity rail. It was a much more bringing us into a new energy economy. And that's not really what's being talked about now.
What's wrong with what's being talked about, if there is anything wrong with it? Isn't the routine repair and maintenance needed?
Well, no, a lot of it is needed. That's correct. You know, one of the studies a couple years ago said that we were looking at a $1.6 trillion list of things that had to be done. But the problem is that this is it's not really what was being talked about during the campaign.
So it's not meeting the expectations he might have created in the minds of voters.
That's right. It's funny. During the campaign, before things had gotten really bad, there was this talk of expanding infrastructure, but it was not intended as an economic stimulus kind of program. That this was before things had really turned south, and it was just talked about as a way to bring this country into a new era, to bring us into a new energy economy. Now that the economy really went south, it's created an opportunity for a lot of these projects to be sold in terms of on the expenditure side, but it hasn't really. What we're coming up with is a different list of projects than he had talked about during the campaign. It's not. It's giving us this opportunity to drive these projects through Congress, but it's not actually. The kind of things that have been discussed.
You talked about the need for speed, and the president-elect has used the phrase "use it or lose it." What's that about?
Well, you know, the emphasis now is on getting the money out in the street to create the new jobs, and so the message that came out when he had his radio address a couple weeks ago was, we're going to spend this money well, we're going to spend it quickly. That was to sort of assure people that it was not going to get tucked away by the states and get wasted. The problem with this is that a lot of the states hear that message and they think, well, we just have to spend this money immediately and not think hard about how we're really going to use it. And so you end up with these repaving projects, you end up with the bridge redecking projects, and it's on the one hand it's necessary because we have all these backlogged repair needs. On the other hand, it's not taking us to a new energy era, and it could be argued either way, but But it's, the fact is, it's not really what he had in mind to begin with. You know, one of the things that he had talked about most during the campaign was this idea of linking up the industrial Midwest with intercity rail, so that you could get from Detroit to Cleveland to St. Louis to Milwaukee by rail instead of having to fly these kind of short distances. And that's the sort of one of these kind of longer term ideas that some might think consider a boondoggle, but are really a way to get us into a new way of doing things, and that's not what's being talked about right now.
You quote David Goldberg of Smart Growth America in the Washington Post saying it doesn't have the power to stir men's souls. Are there also risks of moving too quickly and building projects that aren't needed or that turn out to be in some way or other out of date?
Well, that is a risk. I mean, what's really the problem right now is that there's not. No one's really thinking hard about this in any way. It's these decisions are going to be made at the state level, in the state capitals, which in most cases are going to be getting this money in kind of a block form, and it's going to be spent by them. Some of them will be thinking hard about this and maybe will be coming up with better projects than others. No one at the national level, though, is really going to be thinking about this in a kind of overarching, cohesive way when it comes to this early money. There's some talk that this could be broken into kind of a two-phase thing where the money will be, you'd have repair and maintenance money spent quickly right at the outset on sort of backlogged maintenance projects, and then you could have a second phase of spending in, say, you know, 6 months or a year, and that money would be spent with more sort of national input, more input from the administration. But it's really unclear how that would work. If you've already spent all the money right at the outset on the repair things, that's not going to leave more for this longer term kind of spending. What this really comes down to, in a way, has to do with rail. A lot of our highway system is pretty built out, and so that's why a lot of the work on highways and bridges is going to be repair work and maintenance work, and that's fine to an extent because you don't want your bridges falling down. So in some sense, it's understandable that we're not going to have a lot of new spending on new highways as we did in the 50s with the interstate system. What if we're really talking about new spending, we're going to be talking about rail and transit. And so that's really what this comes down to. Do we want to be spending a lot of money now to try to get this country off of a completely sort of car-dependent economy, oil-dependent economy, or not really? And right now it's looking as if, despite all the talk during the campaign that this is what he wanted to do, that we're in fact maybe just going to end up doing a lot of patchwork on our highway system.
Alec McGillis again, national reporter political reporter for The Washington Post. James Galbraith is an economist, professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Professor Galbraith, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
You have called for a sort of Keynesian approach to the economy and spending on a Herculean scale. Is that what we're talking about here, or does this sound to you as if it's coming up short?
Well, I don't think we've seen the whole picture here. Clearly, highway road building projects are not by themselves going to pull the entire United States economy out of an extraordinarily violent slump that it has fallen into as a result of the collapse of the credit mechanism. But I think they are a useful step. I think the right approach is to do those things which are quickly implemented and non-controversial relatively quickly, and then to go on and do those things which are operate on a larger scale, which involve multi-states and multi-regional governments, and which require planning and environmental assessment, and those things would not contribute materially to the growth of the economy in the next 6 months because you couldn't get them going that quickly. So they don't really compete with the short-term projects. There is no, the pool of resources is not limited here. There's plenty of construction resources that can be put to use, but which you want to do the things that are set off quickly, and you want to get them going first, and then you want to plan for the bigger things.
Well, what about the money and how much is involved in? I take it you're taking a two-phase approach to this, starting out with the first useful step, maintenance and repair, and then going on to this sort of grander project. Is there going to be money left for that?
Well, I would start first of all by providing funds to help state and local governments meet their services, to pay their bills, to keep their staff. So I would put that first as a revenue sharing program. I would put the roads and bridges second. I would put the National Infrastructure Fund third. You're going to have to, at the same time, to help homeowners stay in their homes. That's also something that's going to involve some, at least, restructuring of cash flows and therefore a use of budget resources. I would raise Social Security benefits and replace some of the income that the elderly population is losing. And I think if you did all of those things, you could begin to approach the scale of effort that's going to be required to deal with the underlying economic collapse. This is not an issue about whether there is some adequate fund of money that the federal government has. The issue is whether the action taken by the federal government is going to be on a sufficient scale to deal with the deep, deep decline that's occurring in the economy, which is a cutting into the cash flow of private business, of nonprofit organizations, of state and local governments, in a way which is self-reinforcing at this point and really causing a more severe kind of implosion of the system than I've ever seen in my professional lifetime. So the task before the administration is to get the scale up, not to keep it under control.
Again, James Galbraith, professor of economics at the University of Texas at Austin. Amity Schles is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Amity Schles, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Do you agree that infrastructure spending is needed for the stimulus package?
I'm not sure the word stimulus is actually productive at this point. There comes a point in a crisis when you have to stop calling it a crisis and start talking about reform. And when we look at how will the U.S. economy come back, what will make the U.S. economy really come back? A stimulus or an infrastructure program, long or short, and I would prefer, as the gentleman from the posted, the longer-term one, the railroad. That's nice. It's good. It will help the economy. It will provide jobs. But the longer-term recovery of the U.S. economy has to be led by the private sector. And that part of the story hasn't happened yet. Specifically, imagine if it's use the image of a game. We have a game that's broken. Our goalposts are broken. We just don't know how the economy works. We don't know how to play the game. And the companies are saying, okay, I'm sitting on the sidelines until the economic game is clear again, until I know what the laws are with the SEC, until I know that we have a regulator who also regulates all those derivatives and things that fell between the cracks, until I know what penalty I will pay, until I know that I can get a real price for the thing I buy or sell, including securities. Once we set up that game, that is, say, the new rules are, the SEC will do, the tax rates will be, we're open for business, you will see money come in, and not just panic money, but other kinds of money to invest in the United States, and you will see companies that are holding off now, sitting on cash maybe, begin to do productive things and invest in the future and so on. So that part of the story has yet to be told and focused upon, and that's one of the concerns in markets. The real problem with this TARP, the government program that the Treasury introduced in the summer, is that it's so uncertain, it's changed its mandate so many times. At first it was to, draw out the toxic assets of banks that had to do with the mortgage crisis. And then it was switched to, let's buy parts of banks and supply liquidity to the banks. And now, even just this weekend, I think we heard someone say, maybe in the White House, that we were going to use maybe the TARP to help the automakers. Since we don't know what the TARP is for and nobody knows who's going to get bailed out, we are frozen, just as Dr. Galbraith said. But the freeze isn't just a monetary freeze. It's a freeze of uncertainty, just like in a game when you don't know the rules.
Again, Amity Schles is with the Council on Foreign Relations, her book, The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. What about the New Deal? And isn't one of the things you're looking at in your book the idea that it was, in fact, a massive government spending that got the economy back in track?
It wasn't the spending, because the spending was never a large enough share of the economy. The government just wasn't big enough in that period to spend. It got big in World War II. Didn't you see that big, big spending? But the problem in the New Deal period, alas, was that this notion that the government was going to rescue. And what happened was, more generally, not just by spending, but also by regulating. So there were big series of missteps by the government, which led to the Depression being great in magnitude. You have the first part of the Depression, this terrible credit event, this terrible deflation that we all know so much about. But then you have these extra years, and that's what we want to avoid now, from, say, 35 or 36 all the way to World War II. What is the analogy that we of something closer, an example of the same thing, more or less, that we want to avoid? Japan, again, in the 90s, I think they had 10 or 11 infrastructure programs in Japan in the 90s. They weren't all so horrible, but often they ended up just being earmarks. That's what we were talking about earlier. You know, when you divide these up in the states, how political did they become? How much less productive? Often they ended up being earmarks or giveaways to very increasingly corrupt construction industry, feeding on this money from the capital. And, you know, and Japan, what was the result at the end? Japanese unemployment was double what it had been at the beginning of the lost decade. Japan's markets weren't coming back the way they should. It was a lost decade, and it was not in the 1930s like the New Deal or the Great Depression. It was very recent, and it was in a country we, you know, our second greatest economy, a country we respect a lot and we're kind of envious of when that experiment started.
Okay, but let me go back to James Galbraith. How can we learn from these experiences that Amity Schles is enumerating and not make the same mistakes over again? Every lobbyist in Washington, no doubt, is rubbing his or her hands at this point.
One of the things to get straight here is what the New Deal actually accomplished. The unemployment statistics that are commonly cited actually count those who worked for the government in those days as though they were still unemployed. The government, in fact, hired about 60% of the unemployed people of that era in public works and conservation projects. And just give you a short list of what they did from a new paper. They built or renovated 2,500 hospitals, 45,000 schools, 13,000 parks and playgrounds, 7,800 bridges, 700,000 miles of roads, and 1,000 airfields. Employed 50,000 teachers, rebuilt the entire rural school system of the country, and hired 3,000 writers, musicians, sculptors, and painters. If you count the people who worked for the New Deal as employed, which they certainly were, then the unemployment in the 1930s falls to 7% in 1936 and 3% by 1940, which is still before the U.S. got involved in the Second World War. So actually, I think the record is not as bleak as Amity Schles likes to make it out, or as many people, in fact, have tried to make it out to be. When my father took a Model T across the United States to go out to Berkeley in 1930, the roads were unpaved from Lincoln, Nebraska to the California line. The New Deal gave us a road system that we continued to use until we built the interstate highway system. Much of it we still use today.
I want to talk about the greening aspect of the Obama plan rather than turning this into a debate about the Great Depression. But obviously, that's a very important issue as we decide how to go forward. So, Amity Schles, let me go back to you. Your book, The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Were there, in fact, the kinds of accomplishment that Professor Galbraith lists, including a reduction of employment, if you include those people employed by the government, to down to 7%, even 3%?
Well, I do not agree with those 7% and 3% data. And by the way, the data that are used in The Forgotten Man are data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, so they are not exactly strange data.
But they didn't count the government workers, according to...
Here's what Dr. Galbraith is referring to, I believe. There's been a big debate since the early data about these public sector jobs, and we're not talking here about the teacher jobs because those were counting. We're even in the data that I have in The Forgotten Man and the official data, which you can retrieve from the BLS and email them, but we're talking about the make-work jobs, which were on a highway for 3 months or so on, and were very, very inspiring to the people or the CCC. We all have relatives who just had intense pride in those jobs in a time of despair. But even when you count those jobs, the first person to do this way, by the way, is a professor named Darby. You don't get to the numbers that Professor Galbraith gets to. You get to about an average of 12% unemployment, which, or 11 or 10, which is a number that any current administration, Republican or Democratic, would run screaming away from. Yes, you were going to have big public infrastructure spending and 10% unemployment. Also, you know, if you quantify the unemployment another way, which people have done, one is Lee Ohanian at UCLA, you see Americans are working 20% less in the late 30s, and that's important to see, and that that, I believe, did include every kind of job.
Okay.
So there's it's interesting that there's a big debate about it. I think it's kind of fun. It's important, and we should all discuss it because we are concerned about will the infrastructure program bring recovery.
All right. Let me bring another element into this, and that has to do with the idea of encouraging a green economy, changing things from what they have been. Will that help to resolve some of the arguments that we're hearing? Bracken Hendricks is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's co-author of Apollo's Fire, Igniting America's Clean Energy Fire. Worked in the Clinton administration for Vice President DeGore on climate change policy. And, of course, the Center for American Progress is involved in the transition to the Barack Obama administration as well. Bracken Hendricks, thanks a lot for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on, Warren.
Tell us, if you will, how you think the idea of after the initial jolt to the economy, presumably won't happen, the green part of the equation presumably won't be brought in at that point. When does it come in? What does it do? How does it help economic recovery?
Well, let me actually push back a little bit on what Alec was saying at the beginning, because I think there is an immediate short-term need for stimulus, as well as a more midterm need for recovery that will involve exactly the sort of things that Professor Galbraith was talking about with sort of investments in infrastructure and upgrading the built environment. But there's an awful lot that can be done very near term. Projects like weatherizing homes, it may not be as romantic, but it's every bit as essential to building a green economy, a low-carbon economy. Things like if we're going to be doing school construction, these are projects that are approved, that are in the pipeline now. We can be building them as green schools, jump-starting a market for clean, new technology, energy efficiency, renewable energy, these sorts of things in the built environment. There's a huge backlog of transit projects, both repair and maintenance and new transit starts that have been approved and are shovel-ready, ready to go. There is a way of pushing money out to the states through a program called the Energy Efficiency Conservation and Block Grant Program. Push several billion dollars out to states and cities very quickly, and that's something that we can spend on right now. So we're looking at a situation which is dire. The real people are genuinely suffering, and what that's amounting to is a contraction of demand. And there's a real convergence among economists that there is a need for a very significant infusion of demand into the economy. Paul Krugman, a progressive Nobel Prize-winning economist, says it's about $600 billion, or 4% of GDP. But Goldman Sachs, coming from Wall Street, say it's about $500 billion. So there really is a fair amount of convergence that we need that investment. We can do it in the near term by spending on a whole host of programs and projects that have been neglected over the last 8 years. And, you know, the sort of thing that Amity was just talking about is absolutely important. We need to do this in a way that's responsible, that actually moves us towards our long-term goals. And I think that elevates the importance of the clean energy strategy, the conversion of our economy. And I would just like to say, though, that this is not just public investment creating those jobs directly. This is exactly what's needed to stimulate private sector confidence, to stimulate new businesses. When we talk about weatherizing homes, when we talk about building new energy systems, these are the areas of the private sector economy that are most poised to grow and most poised to succeed in a global economy as we move to a low-carbon future. This is very, very strategic use of public sector resources now when we need to stimulate that demand, and we can do it in a way that's fiscally responsible, that is economically smart, by jump-starting the private sector activity that we ultimately need to carry us forward.
And when you say that there are available federal programs, and I don't recall the program that you mentioned, but it had the words energy in it, if you do it that way, then you're requiring the states to use the money in certain ways?
Absolutely. There's a block grant program, the Energy Efficiency Conservation Block Grant. It was approved in the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, but the money was never put forward. It was never flowed out to states. There are a whole host of projects that mayors and governors around the country are ready to spend money on that would reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, cut our reliance on oil. Things like weatherizing homes, building green schools, increasing investments in transit, or in the manufacturing heartland. You have folks like Senator Stabenow, who's looking very, very closely at how to rejuvenate investment in manufacturing around new technology like advanced battery systems that we're going to need for electric cars. So there's a whole host of pathways we can use today to move money out. And we've been going through at the Center for American Progress and trying to document existing programs that have not been funded that could be used today to put money into training workers, revitalizing our manufacturing, and rebuilding homes, rebuilding cities to use less energy and put people back to work. We can do these two things at the same time, and over the long term, we'll cut the costs of actually managing our global warming crisis.
So contrary to what we heard from our first guest, Alec MacGillis of the Washington Post, who isn't with us anymore, we wouldn't have to wait then for projects that would help to make good on the promises made by Barack Obama during the campaign.
That's right. And his point is a legitimate one, that governors and mayors have been asked to spend this money quickly, use it or lose it, find shovel-ready projects. The only thing that we're adding is that doesn't have to just be business as usual. We can apply our intelligence, we can be strategic, and, there is $1.6 trillion of unmet infrastructure needs, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. $1.6 trillion of roads that haven't been maintained, bridges that haven't been built, rail that's falling into decline, schools that are in disrepair. We can rebuild these things now if we use green not as a subset of those projects but as a lens for looking at how we make investments. We can be more strategic. We can rebuild communities, put people to work, and we can jumpstart new markets and cut our energy use, which will make us much more secure over the long term.
All right. Obviously, some big, very big decisions are being made right now by the Obama administration. We will see what happens, of course, when they get to the Congress, and we'll talk about it many times on future programs. Hope all of you will join us. Again, James Galbraith, again, at the University of Texas at Austin. His book, The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Amity Schles of the Council on Foreign Relations, The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Bracken Hendricks at the Center for American Progress. His book, Apollo's Fire, Igniting America's Clean Energy Economy, and Alec MacGillis, our earlier guests with the Washington Post. Thanks to you all very much for being with us. That was a rebroadcast of To the Point. Mayor Villaraigosa will have a critical role in the flow of federal money. We'll hear about that in a moment. But other Californians will play even more significant roles in the cabinet and in the White House. We'll hear about them tonight. On Reporter's Notebook, financial problems for homeboy industries. Back in a moment with Which Way L.A.? Warren Only back with Which Way L.A.? Bernard Madoff says losses from his exclusive and fraudulent hedge fund may top $50 billion. What's being called the biggest Ponzi scheme in history was run in downtown Manhattan. But there are victims here in Los Angeles. Rob Eshman is editor-in-chief of the Jewish Journal. And, Rob, always good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Hi.
Who particularly that you're aware of has been hit by this, and by how much?
Well, there's a lot of victims in the Jewish community here. There's a lot of victims, period, but he cut a pretty wide swath of the Jewish community. A major donor in the community today told me this is one of the biggest catastrophes he's ever seen in the community. It's organizations and individuals. The biggest so far, I think, is the Jewish Community Foundation, which has something called a community investment pool of about $230 million, and they say that about $25 million was lost with Madoff.
$25 million bucks is a lot of money. What is that money used for?
Well, that money actually belonged to different smaller affiliate organizations, like Jewish Family Service, Jewish Vocational Service, which, as the names kind of indicate, help people on the streets, help people in all different ways in job training, providing food pantries, mental health counseling. Beit Teshuva, which is an addiction and recovery center for Jewish addicts, took a big hit. I think something like $8 million of it was theirs. The Jewish Federation, which has 13 beneficiary organizations, they lost $6.4 million of their endowment in this community investment pool.
Also, apparently, the foundation of Elie Wiesel, the Nobel laureate, and a charity of the movie director Steven Spielberg. Certainly people familiar here and very important in the Jewish community.
Right. They say the Elie Wiesel Foundation lost $10 million, was wiped out. And an organization called the Chase Family Foundation, which has a high profile here in L.A., was and does a lot for Jewish causes in Israel and the former Soviet Union, it's closing its doors as of today. $12.5 million each year they would give away.
What more can you tell us about Madoff's operation in and of itself? He's the one who says it may have been worth $50 billion. Has anybody confirmed that?
No, I think there's a lot of accountants and a lot of lawyers who have a full-time job now looking into this. It's unclear, and the individual victims are just coming forward. We heard from one family today that lost $30 million. So it's not clear, but it was a Ponzi scheme. He didn't have the money he said he had. He used some investors' money to pay off other investors, and when too many people wanted their money back at once, the whole thing collapsed.
And when you say a local family lost $30 million, a lot of these people were apparently friends of Madoff, and you couldn't get into it in the normal way. It was a sort of word-of-mouth kind of thing where I guess people felt very lucky to be involved.
No, and that was his modus operandi. We have a reporter who was searching around in Florida to find out, you know, where he went to synagogue. And the truth is he kept a pretty low profile to maintain this air of exclusivity and kind of aloofness from the community. And it seems like his modus operandi was to use these rainmakers, people who would collect, who would create partnerships, and they would get people to invest in these partnerships, and then they would turn over the money to Madoff. So in some cases, people had no direct dealing with Madoff, can't sue him, can't go after him because they were part of these partnerships, which lost all this money.
What about people in his own family who were involved in other of his operations?
Well, he has two sons, and they were the ones who he confessed to, who said it's all been a lie, and they turned him in. But I don't think anybody's certain at this point whether they were involved or not.
Okay. Well, this is a story, obviously, that's going to go on for some time here in the Jewish community in Los Angeles and well beyond it. Rob Eshman, want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Warren.
Rob Eshman, the editor-in-chief of the Jewish Journal. You can follow that story. He'll be updating it on jewishjournal.com. Back in a moment with Which Way L.A.
You're listening to Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
We're on back with Which Way L.A. Barack Obama has tapped two Californians for major roles in setting a new agenda. Here's what he said today about California's progress in energy and the environment.
Consistently, California has hit the bar, and then the rest of the country has followed. Rather than it being an impediment to economic growth, it has helped to become an engine of economic growth. And one of the key points that I want to make at this press conference, and I will repeat again and again during the course of my presidency, is there is not a contradiction between economic growth and sound environmental practices.
Again, Barack Obama today announcing a couple of appointments, which we'll hear about in a moment. Felicia Marcus is a founder of Heal the Bay. She was EPA regional administrator during the Clinton years. She's now Western Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council. And Felicia Marcus, thank you very much for being on our program.
Oh, thank you, Warren. It's great to be back.
Pretty interesting that he would pick out California in the way that we just heard him do, particularly in the context of growth and the environment. Before we talk about these nominees today, what exactly do you think does he mean?
Oh, well, I think California has, you know, led the nation for years. I mean, since the beginning of the environmental laws, the whole nation's looked to California for leadership and innovation on energy and environmental issues. And at times in the Clinton administration, we felt the state wasn't stepping up to the plate. We were dismayed in part because we had to step in, but also because we knew that everybody else looked to California. I had to have a full-time person when I was at EPA Region 9 just taking international visitors on tours because this was the place to come to see how the future was going to be dealt with, particularly in the air quality arena. So I think that's part of it, and I think it's great that he knows that.
All right. The first, the highest level appointee from California is not directly involved with the environment, but we'll see in what ways he might be. He is Stephen Chu, who's director of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, which principally oversees nuclear waste and weapons development, but it also does research into alternative energy and upgrading the electricity grid. Tell us more about him, if you can, and what goes on at the lab.
Well, he is he's a stunning appointment. I do not know him personally, but everybody who does just thinks he's a fabulous human to begin with, and so that's always fabulous when you get somebody appointed who is what my grandfather would call a regular person, who's just very substantive. But he has the technical and the management skill on these issues, combined with a passion for making a difference on climate that is truly stunning. And under his leadership, he has really tried to make the lab a force for cutting-edge research on a new energy economy, new energy technologies, breaking down this totally artificial and ridiculous divide between energy and the environment that has evolved over time. And he's that leading edge on biofuels, on renewable technologies, on the transmission systems that it takes to get the electrons where we need them to go, and an incredible history of being a supporter of energy efficiency as part of that, as the cheapest and quickest way.
And Stephen Chu is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. He replaces a former chemical company CEO and financial services executive as the cabinet secretary in charge of the Energy Department. That's pretty significant, too.
It's stunning.
Another official appointed today by President Obama, President-elect Obama, is Nancy Sutley, who is a deputy mayor in Los Angeles who oversees energy and environmental issues. She, too, had a comment today to make, and let's hear from her.
We have seen states like California and cities like Los Angeles take on local and global environmental threats, innovate and create a more sustainable path. You're rightly focused on restoring the federal government to its rightful role as a leader and a partner at home and abroad in protecting public health and our environment.
Back to Felicia Marcus. Put what we just heard in context, if you will.
Well, I think for years, I mean, even going back to the time when I was working in the city of L.A. in the late 80s, early 90s, cities across the country have been leaders on climate change. They have been stepping up and talking about this issue for years when the state and the federal government have been absent. In recent years, the state has stepped up really extraordinarily in California, and so has the city, but the federal government has been absent. So Nancy, I think, is calling for the federal government to come back and take its rightful role as a player, both domestically and as part of the international community, but in a way that acknowledges the leadership of cities in this work, which I was pleased to hear President-elect Obama mention as well.
Okay, we have two agencies then, the Department of Energy and the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Tell us a bit, if you will, based on your experience, about the competition between agencies of the federal government whose duties may, as these do, overlap, and what you think that President-elect Obama intends to do about that.
Well, I think with these selections, he is sending a very clear signal that he wants the agencies and the people involved to work together towards a common end. I mean, one of the things that was just tragic to me in the in watching how the agencies would fight. It's not just turf wars. It's in part, it's just human. I always say the biggest challenge in this work isn't something like ecosystem management. It's ecosystem management, where people just want their face time, or they want their issues heard, and they don't think necessarily about the greater good. So you have the Energy Department, which is a behemoth in size, and you have FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, you have EPA, of course, you have offices within the State Department, within transportation, within housing, and all of them are vying for their vision of what is good. And then it gets even worse within the White House, not through any malfeasance, it's just the way it's been set up, which is where you have the Council on Environmental Quality at one end of the building, you have the Office of Management and Budget with their people on another part of the building, then you have an office called OIRA, the Office of, I'm not sure what the I is, something in Regulatory Affairs that has to review all regulations. Then you have the Domestic Policy Council, you have teams in Intergovernmental Relations, you have people over at Commerce and NOAA, and so you end up with an incredible sea of people who all are jockeying for influence. And so by hiring both, in particular, Carol Browner, who has a prodigious...
I haven't heard about her yet. She's not a Californian, but she's going to be head of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, and she is. We can talk about her. She's going to be head of the
a new energy and environment team within the White House, sort
Excuse
of a
me.
Super.
She's the one in charge of coordinating. I beg your pardon.
Yes, everything, and I think we can talk about that in a moment. But I think he sent the signal that it's sort of kids, we want you to work well together, and we want to get something done focused on results, because the people he's appointed are all, let's just say, low glamour, high value workhorses. I mean, people who are known for being focused on results, listening to all players, and being able to integrate and assimilate lots of information and come out with a solution. I mean, these are. It says he means business.
Let me just be clear. Carol Browner was President Clinton's EPA chief, and the job that she will take, as I understand it, as you just said, an environmental czar kind of job, where coordination will be her major responsibility. Is that the way you understand it?
Yeah, that's the way I understand it, and we'll obviously hear more about it in the weeks to come. But I think she has an extraordinary firsthand experience of navigating that system and it's all of its inefficiency through trying to get the clean air standards through and any host of really important items that bring the economy and the environment together, which is something that I was happy to also hear the president-elect say over and over again and all of the speakers say. I think she will be able to keep people's eye on the ball and not devolve to that very human competitive spirit that can sometimes get in the way of real progress.
Again, Felicia Marcus is a founder of Heal the Bay, worked in the Bradley administration here in Los Angeles, was EPA regional administrator during the Clinton years. She's now Western Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Now, all the federal money in Barack Obama's recovery plan, which we heard about earlier on our program, will be funneled through state and local officials. That means the mayor of Los Angeles will have new powers and new responsibilities. His biggest job will be to speed up local bureaucrats, whose slogan is, saying no never gets you into trouble. That's according to Bill Byorski, who is a former city editor, columnist, and reporter for the Los Angeles Times, now writes for TruthDig.com and LA Observed. And Bill Byorski, always good to hear from you.
Warren, that's right. This does place a huge responsibility on the mayor. Because he's got great power in his own office, and he's really the single most powerful and best known elected official in the whole Los Angeles area beyond the city limits. He also controls, with his own vote, four votes on the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which dispenses the money, and we'll be dispensing the federal money for transportation projects, which are going to be like the Wilshire Subway, which will be a big part of the economic recovery program. And so there, with his votes and picking up two or three more, he has the ability to speed up these projects and, you know, tell them to say more than just say no.
Well, what about just saying no, and how do you get them not to?
Well, you order them to. That is one way. I mean, the first thing that's happening with these funds, they'll go from Washington and they'll either go through the state houses or to city halls or to both. There's a big fight going on now between the urban mayors, the big city mayors, and the states about whether the money should go directly to city halls or whether they should be funneled through the state capitals around the country. The mayors want them to go directly to City Hall, and then they want to speed up those operations. Now, the mayor of Los Angeles has, one, the bully pulpit of his office, but two, he has the ability to fire department heads who don't do what he says. And as I said before, he has the ability to get his way on the board of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which is probably the biggest single agency in this whole recovery effort.
He also has pretty good connections with Barack Obama. He was there for the economic meeting when that took place, and when Hillary Clinton resigned from the campaign, took herself out of the campaign, the mayor immediately switched allegiances, and that seems to have done him some good.
Well, that's right. He does have good connections, and I mean, and he's an important political figure here. And when he was in Washington for that meeting, he and the other mayors, like Bloomberg of New York, made a hard pitch to have these funds go directly through their city halls. This is going to take a change on the mayor's part. This is an incredibly complicated job. I mean, I just thought, listening to Felicia reel off all those agencies just involved in the environment, up and down the halls and all the approvals that you need. This is going to be a tough job for the mayor. He's going to have to push his way through the Washington bureaucracy, use all of his political influence, and then here in Los Angeles, keep track of all of these projects, see where they're going, and move them ahead, put them on a fast track. That's going to require a change from him, because he just does flit from one thing to another. And during this whole period of the recession and the joblessness and the Obama election and the preparation of the recovery plan, he was also deeply involved in this whole effort to, you know, fire the school superintendent, which took a lot of energy. And he's going to just say, okay, I'm going to do one thing now. We've got a national emergency. We've got this, all this unemployment, and it's getting worse, and it's hitting my city hard.
Let me go back to Felicia Marcus. Nancy Sutley, who now works for Mayor Villaraigosa, is going to be head of the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Does that mean, do you think, that there will be an effort to try to get, even in this first phase of the Obama recovery plan, which will funnel all this money through capitals, state capitals, and city halls, to try to coordinate those projects so that they reflect the concern about the environment and about energy efficiency and global warming?
I'm certain that that's the case, and I was happy to hear it said over and over again in the press conference that there are projects to be done and efforts to be made that can move very, very quickly to create jobs and set us on the path towards a more secure energy future, starting with the building energy efficiency retrofits and the like. So I think that is very much a part of the strategy of putting together this particular team, starting with Steve Chu and Carol Browner and Nancy Sutley, and of course Lisa Jackson, I'm sure, is with that as well.
Bill Boyarsky, we don't have a lot of time left, but can all this green the lobbyists at City Hall, do you think?
Can it what?
Can they green the lobbyists at City Hall?
Well, that's going to be hard. That's going to be hard to do. But you know, the lobbyists are mostly lobbyists for big construction projects.
Yeah.
And so I think that they ought to be right on this effort. For their own good.
We shall see. Bill Boyarsky again, formerly with the LA Times, now at truthdig.com, and LA Observe. Felicia Marcus with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. Homeboy Industries employs 8,000 young men and women who are former members of gangs all over Los Angeles County. Created by Jesuit Father Gregory Boyle 20 years ago, Homeboy Industries is now a non-denominational nonprofit that runs a bakery and cafe as well as solar energy and landscaping project. It makes money, but not enough to be self-sustaining. And now some of its funding sources are drying up. Father Gregory Boyle joins us tonight. And Father Greg, always good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Tell us a bit about what's happening.
Well, 25% of our income comes from our businesses, and that leaves another 75% that's relying on contributions, and about 18% comes from government, and that's about to dry up. And certainly individuals and foundations have all starting to pull back and shrink from even previous commitments, even telling us that they were going to give us funding, and then have, in the light of how rapidly things change in the economic world, and now aren't going to. So, and we're kind of the city and the county's reentry program. We're kind of it in terms of the variety of services and the comfort level with which thousands and thousands of gang members from every zip code in the city and county show up at our door. So we want to keep our doors open.
I think a lot of people would agree that this is the most successful anti-gang program, if that's what you want to call it, in Los Angeles County. What is the budget when you say 25% comes from earnings of the industries themselves?
So that's about $2.5 million from our businesses. But our budget is $9.8 million. million dollars. So we have all these free services, lots of mental health counselors, free tattoo removal. We do this for the county. 85% of our clients are on probation, so we remove tattoos even from kids who are in probation camps, shackled, who come here to get their tattoos removed. And we don't get any money for that, but we do it. You know, it's part of our mission is to provide all those services for free, and that costs money.
If you don't get the money you need, what happens first? What's the most likely to go?
Well, we won't have an ability to pull people into this place, which is really more of a community than it is a program. So, and that's the strongest thing we do is it's a place to create hope immediately, where you can say to a kid who just got out of a probation camp, come on in, and we'll put you in the bakery. We'll have you in the headquarters, and we'll put you to work and offer our curricular services and the classes and the like. But we stopped doing that for some time, you know, probably since September at this point. So
now
that's the guts of who we are. So
yeah, this is after a history of being open to people that of the kind that you have described any time.
For 20 years, and I'm not alone in saying this is I've never seen anything like this, where people just stop giving money because they're nervous and anxious, and you know, who can blame them? But I'd hate to, this city and this county can ill afford to have this place go under, frankly.
I think that's true, and I've been a reporter in Los Angeles for a long time and watched this institution grow, and to say that it's more a community than a program is a good way to put it. Elaborate a bit on what you mean by that.
Well, it's not just services offered. You know, even if I pull somebody in and say, I'm not sure what you're going to do here, but I know for certain what will happen to you. They get a sense of a new identity, where they abandon the old gang identity, and they reattach. They have an attachment experience that really will enable a certain sense of resilience so that we can send them out into the world, and they won't reoffend. So there's lots that happen to somebody who comes through our doors, a lot more than just locating a job or a paycheck.
You have the bakery and cafe, very successful down there near Union Station in the heart of the city, landscaping projects, solar power projects. Do you also farm people out to other companies or private companies around the region?
We do, and all the more reason why our waiting area is flooded with young men and women is that it's hard for them on their own to find jobs. Nobody's hiring. People are laying off. So the demand for our services is even greater than it's, in fact, ever been. So all the more reason for, we can't shrink from what we offer to the city at a time when this population needs this help more than ever.
Let's get to the nitty-gritty. If people want to contribute to Homeboy Industries, how do they do it?
They can send it to go online, www.homeboy-industries.org, or to 130 West Bruno Street, L.A., California, 90012.
Heart of the city, you like to say that.
Yeah, we say it's in the heart of the city, and it represents the heart in as much as it offers hope to folks for whom hope is foreign.
www.homeboy-industries.org, 130 West Bruno Street, Los Angeles, 90012. Father Greg Boyle, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
Which Way LA, produced tonight by Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, and Sonia Geis. Our managing producers, Carolyn Ranziner, technical director, Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.